Good afternoon. I'd like to call the Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Thursday, April 7th. Let the record reflect. It's 3:32. Today we have present myself, Vice Chair, and we have Senator Holland with us today. The Chair Schauer, Costello, and Senator Kawasaki will be calling in. And as of right now, I see Senator Kawasaki and Senator Costello. Thank you. Welcome to Senate State Affairs. I'd like to remind... Hello. Thank you. I'd like to remind committee members and those in the audience to silence your cell phones because me and Senator Costello owe the last committee donuts, so it's the first time that's happened to me in a couple of years. So anyway, the staff will be that is assisting us today is Naresh, so thank you, Naresh, and Carrie with Senate Records and Nate with the LIO, so thank you for being here. There were five bills on the schedule today. As you know, Chair Schauer likes to pack this committee full of bills. However, two of the bills, Senate Bill 205 and Senate Bill 57, so Senate Bill 57, will not be heard as scheduled because the sponsors of these bills were either not available or they are away on other business. So we will be hearing three bills today. The first bill that we are going to hear is Senate Bill 194. This is an act relating to electronic identification cards relating to electronic driver's license and permits relating to motor vehicle liability insurance and providing for effective date. That will be Senator Kawasaki. Then I will be doing SB 215, an act relating to Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. And then House Bill 234 will be up, an act relating to political contributions, and I believe that's Representative Schrage. So with that, the script says that the two bills, one is Senator Reback's bill, the digital absentee voting will not be heard today, and the Sunset Commission will not be heard by Senator Hughes today. So we're going to go ahead and move to the bills. We're going to first bill up is Senate Bill 194, and I'll ask Senator Kawasaki and his staff to please come up to the table.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My staff will do the introduction of the sponsor statement and the sectional analysis, but I just wanted, Senator Scott Kawasaki, District A, representing Fairbanks, Badger Road, and Fort Wainwright. I just wanted to thank you for hearing Senate Bill 184. The bill, if adopted, would provide convenience to Alaskans by allowing them to carry digital versions of their driver's licenses or permits or state identification card on their mobile devices. These phones are about as ubiquitous as just about anything. I don't leave home without it. Sometimes I've left home without my ID, though. the idea for this bill came back from a constituent back in September, and we've been fine-tuning it with him. And so I just wanted to put a plug out there for the constituent who brought this up. Alaskans have had the freedom to use their smartphones for auto insurance since 2013, I believe, and hunting and fishing licenses since 2018. It seems logical that they be granted the same freedoms to use an electronic version of their driver's license or learner's permit or state ID card as well. I just wanted to thank you, Madam Chair, for bringing this this measure forward and to the other members of the committees for hearing the bill. My co-worker, Stuart Relay, will walk the committee through the sponsor statement and sectional analysis if you want.
Thank you, Senator Kawasaki. And with that, please proceed.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Stuart Relay, staff to Senator Kawasaki. First off, I'd like to thank you and the committee for hearing this bill, SB 194. As you said, the introduction is an act relating to electronic identification cards relating to electronic driver's licenses and permits relating to motor vehicle liability insurance and providing for an effective date. And as Senator Kawasaki said, I will walk the committee through the sponsor statement and the sectional analysis. Starting with the sponsor statement, so smartphones and other smart mobile electronic devices have become an indispensable part of modern life. These devices provide convenient communication, information, and entertainment, such that there is almost no aspect of life that smartphones have not made easier. SB 194 seeks to leverage these modern communication technologies to enhance convenience for Alaskans and allow them to use electronic versions of their driver's license, driver's permits, or state identification cards. Alaskans are currently required to carry physical driver's licenses and permits when driving or operating a vehicle, and this bill would just allow them to carry digital versions show them when requested by Department of Public Safety personnel and local peace officers. On top of increasing convenience, this bill protects the licensee and the user of the smart device, as well as the local law enforcement and DPS. It protects the privacy of the licensee by prohibiting peace officers and DPS personnel from accessing other components of their mobile device, and it protects DPS and local law enforcement from liability resulting from any potential damage to the device except for intentional misconduct. And as Senator Kawasaki said in his opening remarks, Alaskans have been allowed to use their smartphones to display proof of insurance since 2013 and use their smartphones to display fishing and hunting licenses since 2018. Therefore, it is logical that Alaskans be allowed to use their smartphones to display electronic versions of their driver's licenses, driver's permits, and state identification cards. And with that, Madam Chair, I'm going to proceed to the sectional.
Thank you.
Section 1, AS 1865-310 alpha, adds the word physical, specifying the department shall issue a physical identification card upon the payment of a $15 fee. Section 2 adds new subsections, subsection S. It adds new subsections to AS 1865-310. Subsection S, the department may use electronic identification cards. May issue electronic identification cards to those who possess physical identification cards and pay an additional $50 fee and retain their physical identification card. The department shall adopt regulations for issuing and use of electronic identification cards. The Department of Public Safety representatives and peace officers do not search, view, or access other contents of the mobile electronic device without consent. And subsection V, DPS representatives and peace officers are not liable for damages of the mobile electronic device unless for intentional misconduct. Section 3, AS 1865-320 Bravo, adds the word physical, specifying that a person whose physical identification card has been canceled must return the card within 10 days of receiving the cancellation notice or be subject to a $100 fine. Section 4, AS 1865-330, amends the section by adding a definition of electronic identification cards. An electronic identification card is a data file that is specific to an individual that displays a current identification card and is available on a mobile electronic device through an app that allows the individual's data file to be downloaded from the department. Section 5, AS 2805051, that's the word physical, specifying that revoked physical licenses shall be immediately returned to the department upon receiving notice and allows the DOA commissioner or officers and employees of DOA, as well as judges and court employees, to take possession of a physical license. Section 6 adds the word physical or electronic, specifying that drivers must possess physical or electronic Alaska driver's licenses. Section 7, AS 2815, adds a new subsection. That is subsection 126. So it's now AS 2815-126, titled Electronic Licenses and Permits. And it says that DOA may issue electronic driver's licenses or permits to a person who possesses a physical license or permit, and drivers shall retain their physical licenses. The commissioner shall adopt regulations to issue electronic licenses or permits, and they may adopt regulations to require physical licenses in certain circumstances. The department shall display notice of seizure, revocation, cancellation, or limitation across the front of a person's electronic driver's license. Section 8, AS 2815-131 alpha, adds the words physical or electronic, specifying that drivers must have a physical or electronic license in immediate possession when driving, and drivers must surrender their license when required by DPS representatives or peace officers. Section 9, AS 2815-131 adds new subsections. Subsection C, DPS representatives or peace officers cannot search, view, or access other contents of the mobile electronic device without consent. Subsection D, DPS representatives or peace officers are not liable for damages of the mobile electronic device unless for intentional misconduct. Section 10, AS 2815-151 alpha, adds to that subsection that the department shall maintain files of every application for an electronic driver's license or permit and the permits and licenses issued by the department. Now, Madam Chair, sections 11 through 21 are conforming language. They simply add the word physical to each of those sections specifying physical licenses. And for the committee's time, I can proceed to section 22. Or read through each of the next 10 sections.
I think that you should go ahead and proceed, but I would also, once we get to questions, want everybody to know that Jeffrey Schmitz with the DMV director is online if anybody will eventually have questions. So with that, if you can go ahead and proceed.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. With section 22. So section 22 is AS 28-15-271-alpha, and that is on the bottom portion of page 3 of the sectional analysis. And this section increases the licensing fees and adds a fee for electronic driver's licenses or permits. It increases the non-commercial license fee from $20 to $31, the commercial license fee from $100 to $155, instructional permits from $15 to $23, duplicate driver's licenses from $15 to $23 as well, temporary licenses or renewals of a permit from $5 to $8, school bus driver endorsements also from $5 to $8, and electronic driver's licenses or permits. It establishes a fee for electronic driver's licenses or permits at $50. Section 23, AS 28-2560. Adds the word physical, specifying that if a person whose license or registration is revoked under this chapter, they shall immediately return their physical license or registration to the department. Section 24 amends AS 28-22-019-Delta, requiring DPS representatives or peace officers who are presented with proof of motor vehicle liability insurance on a mobile electronic device to return the device once they verify the person possesses, who in fact possesses liability insurance. Section 25, AS 28-22-019 adds a new subsection, subsection F, that a DPS representative or peace officer is immune from liability if the mobile electronic device used to determine motor vehicle liability insurance is damaged. Section 26 adds the word physical, specifying that when imposing limitations under this section, the department shall require the surrender of a driver's physical license. Section 27 adds a new subsection, subsection gamma. The department may issue electronic commercial driver's licenses. Section 28 adds the words physical, specifying that if the court disqualifies a person driving a commercial motor vehicle, the person shall surrender their physical license. Section 29, AS 28-35-034, adds the word physical, specifying that if a person must surrender their physical license or permit if it has been revoked under AS 28-15-165 or 28-15-181. Section 30 adds a new AS 28-90-990-alpha adds a new paragraph, paragraph 33. Defines an electronic driver's license or permit as a data file that is specific to an individual that displays the current driver's license and is available on a mobile electronic device through an app that allows individuals' data file to be downloaded from the department. Section 31, AS 33-16-150 India, adds the words physical, specifying that in addition to other conditions of parole imposed under this section, the board shall require the surrender of a physical driver's license or identification card and forward them to the department. Section 32 provides the Department of Administration the ability to adopt regulations necessary to implement this act. Section 33 provides an immediate effective date for Section 32, and Section 34 provides an effective date of January 21, 2023, except for it's provided in Section 33. And that, Madam Chair, is the sectional analysis.
Wow. For something so simple, it's amazing how many sections, what a huge sectional that was. So I'm going to see if Senator Kawasaki, after that, did you want to weigh in on anything?
No, Madam Chair. I guess just something that can be reiterated is that it's a voluntary thing. People don't have to surrender their driver's license now. You know, if a person just wants to carry a paper or a paper or plastic one, that's fine. It's not making them do it. But I think this is an added benefit of freedom that I think it'll pass. I know that there are a number of other states that are actually looking at it as well, and I think maybe 5 or 6 states have already adopted the policy. So I think it's coming our way. It's just a matter of time.
Okay, with that, I'm going to go ahead and open questions up to the committee members. Does anyone have any questions?
I have a few, Madam Chair, but what we might do is while people are tuned in, because I have the benefit of being here. Okay, I'll just run with my questions. And this could be for the sponsor or Mr. Relay, or even it might be the DMV, but it might be the easiest questions, might be something you get answered here if you've got them right off the bat. But so the fee increase on the bottom of page 7, was that just tied in because it was a convenient time to revisit the DMV fees? And do we know when was the last time the fees were increased by the DMV?
So, Mr. Chairman, that is Section 22, if I recall correctly. And so on top of establishing a fee for an electronic driver's license, it does increase the fees. And this is just as close to the rate of inflation since they were raised. And if I remember correctly, they were last increased in 2002.
Second question.
Yeah, please.
So the electronic driver's license we're talking about is going to be app associated. It's not going to be a digital copy, a picture of your driver's license.
That is my understanding, Chair, but that could also be a question for the department for Director Schmitz, if he has an answer and is available.
Director Schmitz, did you hear that question? And welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much. For the record, my name is Jeffrey Schmitz. I'm the director of Alaska DMV. Can we repeat the question, please?
Senator Schauer. Senator Holland.
Close enough. Thank you, Madam Chair. So, the question is, the electronic driver's license we're talking about is going to be just an associated app driver's license. So it's not going to be a picture of your driver's license that you carry around.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, Jeffrey Schmitz, that is correct. In terms of what it will be and how this will work, I want to be very clear up front that there is no identified process involved with this associated bill. We're learning as we're going here, and along with the bill sponsor, in terms of what their plans were and what their ideas were for implementation and the creation of a mobile driver's license or a mobile electronic driver's license solution. Because currently one does not exist. Somebody mentioned earlier, there are many states across the United States that are looking at this in some form of a pilot or a study or a proof of concept or an individual specific implementation from an individual state or in phased approaches. But there is no universal solution that's created right now that's interoperable between states, and the key issues that really need to be identified in making a solution like this work. So we're talking about a very, very big analysis of what it would take just from a technology standpoint to make it work and make it become a reality. Certainly the concept is something that's been very favorable and something that people have talked about for many years. But the fact of the matter is that there is no universal solution for this type of solution right now. And I thought I'd just mention that as I have the mic here. So free to answer any other questions you might have.
Follow-up?
Yes, please.
So the next question I probably have is, and I understand these may not be the answer to it, but much of the bill is dedicated to altering statements about revoking the physical card. Do we know right now is I would assume it's going to be an electronic app, and I would assume there's going to be somebody with DMV, when the physical card is revoked and withdrawn, that you guys will be able to turn off the electronic card. It's not going to be just solely under the control of the owner of the phone, correct?
Madam Chair, committee members, again, Jeff Schmitz, just to answer that specific question, you know, DMV would need to establish the actual process, the business workflow, and more than likely have to find a vendor that's going to help us create this. And all of that business process would be established in that procurement effort. Just an FYI that our current driver's license contract with our current vendor expires at the end of next year, so through 2023. And DMV does certainly have plans in the procurement process and the RFP process for our new driver's license vendor, whoever that might be, to ask these electronic licensing solutions be brought forward in their RFP proposal. So, you know, we're all ears in terms of wanting to find out from industry how this would work and what the solutions that have been created throughout the nation, throughout the world, that may be applicable to us. But in terms of how exactly will work, we would simply have to learn that because we don't know those facts right now.
And probably a final statement. Thank you, Madam Chair. I do believe I have family who live outside, and I think I've seen an electronic driver's license. So I think there's states already doing it. I look forward to Alaska jumping on board, but I just worry about developing a price structure for a process. We don't know how much it's going to cost just yet. But with that, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And I actually, it's going to go ahead and ask a couple questions now because there's no one else waiting. So bottom line for me is, how does this interact with the Real ID? I think the sponsor, Seneca was talking, and I both have great reservations for Real ID. We've been fighting that for years. But I would like to know how this would impact that. And that would be directed to Director Schmidt.
Madam Chair, committee members, again, for the record, Jeff Schmitz. To answer your question, this is something that we would have to study in terms of how the electronic solution would be applied to Real ID rules and regulations. However, as was mentioned earlier, there are multiple states, I believe as much as 32 other states that are looking at this right now and trying to develop an interoperability ability to have electronic solutions be available in regardless of what state you go to, that those standards are being written and developed and discussed between states right now. And it's certainly, Alaska can certainly join in that conversation in terms of trying to find out how all of this would work. But those specific questions have not been defined yet. And we really don't know what the solution or how that would work without studying the issue to that level of degree.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, it sounds like there's a lot of unknowns, and there's lots of things that you may do or shall do in Section 2815.126 electronic license permit. So I just going to ask you one more question. If you take off, do you think the fee increases are reasonable? And that would be question number one. Question number two, is there any other really deep concerns, I should say, with the bill? And if so, can you hone in on the areas that DMV actually would like us to work on?
Madam Chair, committee members, Jeff Schmitz again. Thank you for the question. I do appreciate that. In terms of the fee structure, DMV really cannot comment on whether what we feel is reasonable or not. We did do in our fiscal analysis and our fiscal note that was submitted sort of add up what all those would add up to be. But we don't know from the bill sponsor or from the bill writer how those were determined and why they were determined to be what they are. We don't have any sort of point of reference as to what they were thinking there. But simply, that would be additional revenue that the state would collect. It would be an expensive effort to build the system, electronic system, on our own. I think that in our fiscal note, we put together more than a $10 million estimate, and it would simply be an estimate at this point in putting an electronic solution together on our own. So it would be an expensive endeavor. So certainly, fee increases with respect to licensing and electronic licensing options would make sense to help pay for that. So we really have sort of a neutral approach on whether or not we feel they're responsible or not. We're not in a position to really answer that question. With respect to concerns, you know, DMV has put forth a neutral approach to this concept. We don't either support it or not support it. We're right in the middle, and certainly, you know, our role is to do whatever the state directs us to do, and all the laws are passed, we'll do, and we're happy to do that. I will say that this is a concept in terms of electronic mobile solutions that is an exciting concept on several fronts, and it is where our industry is going. Whether we address it now or in the near future, it is something that's coming in the future. So we, I believe, have an obligation to take a close look at this and to see what it would mean in terms of cost and infrastructure and security of information and all those things that you mentioned earlier. Those things would need to be done via study, so we fully understand exactly what the implications of this are. But it is something that, you know, industry and our partners across the country are all looking at, because it just seems to make a lot of sense in terms of how we would, you know, conduct business in terms of licensing and renewals of licenses and things of that nature in the future. Lots of possible advantages to, you know, licensing renewals in rural Alaska and places where we have challenges providing services now and those types of things. In the future, having things to be able to done more electronically is something that we're definitely supportive of. But in terms of how it works and what the exact solution is, we simply don't have an opinion at this point.
Okay, thank you, Director. And before I go to the Stewart, I would like to see if Senator Kawasaki, after all those comments and questions, if you wanted to add anything.
No, I don't think I need to add anything at this point.
Okay,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And with that, Stewart?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, Stewart Relay Staff to Senator Kawasaki. So just on the context of the $50 fee that we established in Section 22, when we were drafting the bill, we didn't know how much this was going to cost. We didn't have a fiscal note yet. And so when drafting, we kind of just went with an arbitrary number. And then as this bill continues its way through the process, that can obviously be adjusted by you as the committee members, or in its next committee of referral, if it is so honored. But yes, so just adding some more context to the fee for electronic driver's licenses.
Okay, thank you. Did you have any other?
Yeah, a final comment. Thank you, Madam Chair. I found there's like five states are doing it. It might be something to do. Let's see what other states charge as electronic fee. Give us a kind of like an idea of the direction to go in. But appreciate it. Thanks so much. I think it's a great idea.
Thank you, Senator Holland.
And thank you for being here today. And we will, I'm sure, probably hear this at another date. I don't want to speak for the chair right now, but I'm pretty sure he'll have this back up. So with that, we're going to go ahead. And, he wanted me to say that amendments are due on this bill Monday, April 11th, close of business. So just a note to committee members on Monday. 5 p.m., I would guess that would be for many. Okay, and so with that, we're going to move on to the second item right at 4 o'clock. And so I will be speaking to the sponsor statement and the intent of the bill, and then my staff, Kelly Toth, will be coming up, and we're going over the sectional. So with that, I'm bringing before Senate State Affairs SB 215. So this is the third session that I have brought this bill. I put it in the play for trying to get it passed. So maybe the third time is a charm. We'll see. What this bill does, SB 215, it's an act relating to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, requiring state departments, agencies, municipalities, school districts, Native corporations, the University of Alaska, and other entities that receive state funds to report federal receipts and relating to the increase of an appropriation based on additional federal or program receipts. So it's known as the Federal Receipts Fiscal Accountability Act, and this is when the LBNA shall annually review a report recommended and recommend to the legislature to make, reduce, or repeal any appropriations based on the report. The Federal Receipts Reporting Agency creates transparency in federal funds received that the legislature did not appropriate. And I'm just going to add, The RPL process is another bill that came before us just 2 days ago, and this again deals with the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. We actually have a meeting in the morning, but this is really important because there's federal funding that comes outside of the legislature, yet we're supposed to be the appropriating branch. So this basically just streamlines it so the legislature actually knows other funds that agencies are getting. So SB 215 creates transparency in the budget process so the legislature can fulfill its constitutional duties. So I'm going to go ahead and keep me a couple more comments as my Chief of Staff, Kelly Toth, comes to present the sectional. The bottom line in this report is they'll be able to, the legislature, after getting this information on this pretty comprehensive report, will be able to review a local plan and recommend that they get additional appropriations, reduce them, or potentially repeal appropriations. And what this does is it also makes the different agencies plan for future. And basically, it's based on the state of Utah. I've been working on this actually since 2014. The state of Utah had a plan put in place. So if there was a reduction of, let's say, 5% of federal receipts, what were they going to do? What was their plan if there was a reduction to meet those needs? And so it basically not only is a transparency bill, but it actually helps plan for future changes. So with that, welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Am I doing this? I'm Kelly Toth, for the record, staff to Senator Reinbold, and thank you for hearing this bill. Today, I'm going to do the sectional analysis for SB 215. As you said, the Federal Receipts Fiscal Accountability Act. So Section 1 of this bill adds a new section, the short title. This act may be known as the Federal Receipts Fiscal Accountability Act. Section 2, AS 2420-206, is amended to read Section 2430-206, Duties of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, is amended to read, review the annual report submitted by the Office of Management and Budget for the preceding fiscal year at the next regular meeting of the committee and recommend to the legislature whether to make, reduce, or repeal any appropriations based on that report. Section 3, AS 3705, is amended, adding a new section to Article 2 to read Section 3705-215, Federal Receipts Reporting Requirement, adds a new section to Article 2 to read. Each municipality, state agency, school district, corporation organized under 43 U.S.C. 1602, and as amended, Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, and any other entity that receives state funds shall prepare and submit a report to the Office of Management and Budget on a form prescribed by Office of Management and Budget that states the total amount of federal receipts received for the previous year, identifies all conditions or requirements must be met to receive the federal receipts not appropriated by the legislature. States where federal receipts received for the previous state fiscal year that were not appropriated by the legislature require a match, supplement, or replacement upon acceptance of the receipts or when the receipts diminish, states the percentage of the entity's total budget that the federal receipts not appropriated the previous year describes an operating plan. If there is a reduction of between 5 and 25% of the amount of federal receipts and more than 25% in the amount of federal receipts received. On or before October 31st each year, a principal department of the state shall prepare and submit a report to the Office of Management and Budget on a form that describes a plan created for operating the department if there is a reduction between 5 and 25% in the amount of federal receipts and more than 25% in the amount of federal receipts by the department. For a municipality that is a school district, separate reports for the municipality and the school district shall be prepared and submitted. If the municipality applies for federal receipts on behalf of another entity, the municipality shall be responsible for preparing the report. If the municipality has less than 200 people, they may seek assistance from the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. The Office of Management and Budget shall prepare and submit a compiled report to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee and identify municipalities that and state agencies that did not submit the information required in the section. Section 4, Section 3707080B is amended to read 3. Should the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee recommend within the 45-day period that the state not initiate additional activity, the governor shall again review the revised program and submit a newly revised program to the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. 4. If the governor submits a newly revised program under 3 of this subsection, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee must recommend that the state initiate additional activity under the newly revised program before commencement of the expenditures.
Thank you very much. So with that, I'm going to see if there are any questions online. I will start with Senator Kawasaki.
Nothing for me.
Okay, thank you. Any questions at this time?
So this has been, you said, 3 sessions or 3 years?
3 sessions.
So a lot of time to discuss this, Madam Chair. I'm just curious, have any stakeholders come out against this for what reasons?
Oh, absolutely, yes. People don't want to show where they're getting hidden money. Or even maybe hidden money is not the right. It's money that has not been appropriated by the legislature. Certainly, they don't want to show their hand. They don't want to show all their funds. So we did a few years back get a letter. I think it was from the Municipal League. Of course, they don't want to be showing all their sources. But I think as a legislature, it's absolutely critical that the legislature, who has the constitutional responsibility for appropriating, get a handle on where. The federal funding is coming from, who it's and who it's going to, so that we can better understand what the real budget is. And what the problem as well is sometimes they end up receiving money and then there's a whole bunch of requirements like matching funds. So then they come to us and they want matching funds. And I just think it's super important for the legislature to have more transparency. So once again, this legislative session, I said I was going to really, really work on strengthening the legislative branch, and this does. This allows us to have much more knowledge about what's going on in our communities and at agencies so we can make better decisions when we are doing the budget.
Follow up?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just worry about this being the evil opposite of the Paperwork Reduction Act. And I can imagine, I would be interested to hear from some of the department heads in the state as to looking at this, as to what kind of personnel burden this puts on them. And that'd be my greatest concern on it. But I do believe the goal is noble. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you. So what we've looked at it a little bit in regards to how much burden really is this on the municipalities and things, and they already have to account for everything already. So we've called, we've looked into, and so they have it on their books. Because it's using federal funds, there's requirements that they have to do it. It's just a matter of sending it back. So we, as the constitutional, you know, people have the responsibility of the budget, we actually get to see that they do have other pots of money. So whether it's electronic, it's fine with me, but I just think we need the report.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So with that, what I'm going to just to, we're going to be moving this bill aside in a moment, but I really wanted to say that this is so important. We found out school districts get money that we were not aware of, and they're spending it, and there's all these requirements, and it's really impacting education. I mean, I could go over COVID money just as an example, but it really has transformed some of the federal money that has gone and transformed a lot of education, and a lot of money ends up bypassing the legislature, which I think is completely unfair. And a lot of it, there's tremendous strings attached to it. So not only does this say what is being brought in, so we have a more clear picture, but they also have to plan if there's reductions, if we actually have somebody that wants to actually get the federal debt under control, which it's certainly not happening right now. But I will, this is a little fun fact. we only had a $18 trillion deficit back at one time when I presented, and I believe it's somewhere around 31,000 now. So it's trillion. Wait, did I say billion? Holy mackerel. This is federal. I'm sorry. Trillion. Yeah. So when I was first presenting this bill many years ago, that's what it was. It was Elijah Bernhagen. I usually let each one of my staff pick a bill that they're really passionate about. And Elijah Bernhagen really wanted to do that. And he used the Utah, you know, as an example, and really worked closely with the legislators of Utah, and he actually did a good job. So I would like to give him some credit because we're using a lot of his old information. We'd kept the binder. But with that, the LBNA, they meet during the interim. It's one of my favorite committees. I really like Ledge Budget and Audit, and we meet year-round, and we're going to be having a meeting in the morning. But that's why it makes sense. This bill, so we will be getting the reports even during the interim. And with that, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside. I'm going to see if he had amendments for this bill. Oh, he does. Okay, so cool. Okay, so amendments for this bill, Senate Bill 215, will also be Monday, April 11th at close of business. So if anybody has amendments. And I'd like to recognize Michelle Schauer. We sometimes call her Senator number 21. Thank you for being here. You're just amazing. We love having you around. So the final bill we are going to be hearing today is House Bill 234. Is Representative Schrage here? Or Eric, are you going to be? Okay. Eric Gunderson, please come on up for your boss. I think they're caught up in the budget. So please, you know the routine. Welcome to Senate State Affairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair. All right. Through the chair, for the record, I am Eric Gunderson, staff representative Calvin Schrage. He apologizes for not being able to be here today. He is caught on the floor working on the operating budget. But I really want to say thank you for taking the time to hear House Bill 234. This bill acts to reinstate campaign contribution limits for Alaska's state and local elections. There is a lot to cover, so I'll attempt to keep this presentation brief and concise. I will begin with the sponsor statement and then move on to a brief presentation, which also includes the sectional. House Bill 234 reinstates fair, reasonable, and constitutional political contribution limits while requiring the Alaska Public Offices Commission to increase these limits every 10 years based on Alaska's consumer inflation rates and limits out-of-state donations in state and local campaigns. Alaska has long touted strong and effective campaign finance laws, which have helped to reduce perception and acts of quid pro quo and corruption in our political process. These laws have served to promote better accountability and trust in our elections and elected officials. Last year, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the statutory campaign contribution limits that were implemented by Alaskan voters in 2006 with 73% support. This took place in the Thompson versus Hebden decision. This ruling and the Alaska Public Offices Commission's decision not to implement the new limits advised by commission staff has created legal uncertainty and opened our state and local elections to the threat of unlimited funds from anywhere in the country. HB 234 creates new campaign contribution limits that are in compliance with the ruling of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and Supreme Court precedent, while ensuring limits remain constitutional moving forward. To accomplish this, HB 234 moves Alaska's campaign contributions to a per campaign period basis and increases the individual to candidate limit from $500 per year to $2,000 per campaign period and the group to candidate limit from $1,000 per year to $4,000 per campaign period. It also directs the Alaska Public Offices Commission to adjust these contribution limits for inflation every 10 years. These changes address the concerns laid out by the Ninth Circuit in their decision, as well as the Supreme Court precedent, while upholding the expressed desire of Alaskan voters for fair and reasonable contribution limits in our elections.
Thank you, Eric. And before we move on to the sectional, I want to see if there's any questions First of all, from committee members online and then here in the room. But before we do that, I want to recognize Heather Hebden, who is the Alaska Public Office Commission. And with that, Heather, did you want to put anything on the record regarding the Thompson versus the Hebden decision?
I'm sorry, this is Heather Hebden, Executive Director for the Alaska Public Offices Commission. Chair Reingold, you cut out right there. Sorry, was that a question?
It is a question, so I'll restate it. First of all, welcome to Senate State Affairs. I just wanted to see if you had any comments regarding the Thompson versus Hebden decision.
Thank you, Chair Reingold. I don't really have a comment on it. I believe the record kind of speaks for itself at this point.
Okay, could you remind us exactly? I know that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals struck down the statute of campaign contributions, implementing what the Alaskans voted for in 2006 with 73% support. But what exactly happened just at a very high level in the Thompson versus Hebden decision, just to refresh our memory?
Chair Reingold, the case was actually remanded back to the Ninth Circuit, and a three-judge panel decided to strike down the individual to candidate limit. The out-of-state aggregate limits had already been struck down, and that was not challenged, so they no longer exist. And there was a third limit that was struck down as well. It's escaping me.
Oh, okay, so just to clarify, the out-of-state limit got struck down, so now there can be unlimited. Am I reading that correctly?
Through the chair.
That is correct.
Wow, I actually didn't know that, and that's why I was actually asking for a refresher with the Thompson versus Hebden decision. So I'm going to see if Eric wants to answer, if you'd like to weigh in.
I think Executive Director Hebden made a pretty concise overview. The presentation also goes into it more in depth, so I think.
I forgot about that. Let her get this presentation ready while you start the sectional. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, with that, yeah, we'll get that pulled up. I forgot about that. So with that, Eric, would you like to proceed? Oh, first of all, Senator, do you have any comments?
I'll hold my questions a little bit longer. I'll watch the presentation.
Okay, and did Senator Kawasaki, do you have any questions so far?
No, not yet.
Okay, perfect. Then we will move into the sectional and then the presentation. Eric, please proceed.
Thank you.
State your name.
Eric Gunderson, Staff Representative Shragi for the record. Through the chair, starting with Section 1, which amends AS 15.13020J, directing the Alaska Public Offices Commission to establish a central office that maintains copies of reports filed with the commission available to the public. In doing so, it removes language requiring the commission to establish a regional office in each Senate district, which has been in statute but has not been practiced. Section 2 amends AS 15.13.070B, change the limit an individual may contribute to a candidate, a write-in candidate, or a non-group entity from $500 per year to $2,000 per campaign period. It also changes the amount an individual may contribute to a group to $5,000 a year. Section 3 amends AS 15.13.070C to change the limit a group that is not a political party may contribute per year to a candidate or write-in candidate from $1,000 per year to $4,000 per campaign period. It changes the amount a group that is not a political party may contribute to another group, non-group entity, or political party to $5,000 per year. Section 4 amends AS 15.13.070F, changing the limit a non-group entity may contribute to a candidate, write-in candidate, or another non-group entity from $1,000 per year to $4,000 per campaign period. It changes the amount a non-group entity may contribute to another group or political party to $5,000 per year. Section 5 amends AS 15.13.070G, changing the limit an individual may contribute to a joint campaign for governor and lieutenant governor from $1,000 per year to $4,000 per campaign period. and it changes the limit a group may contribute to a joint campaign for governor and lieutenant governor from $2,000 per year to $8,000 per campaign period. Section 6 amends AS 15.13.070 to include a new subsection H stating contribution limits provided under Section B1, C2, and F of this section do not apply to individuals, groups, or non-group entities contributing to a group or non-group entity that makes solely independent expenditures. It also amends AS 15.13.070 to include a new subsection I, directing the Alaska Public Offices Commission to update contribution limits every 10 years, beginning the first quarter of 2031, based on consumer inflation rates for Anchorage. And these increases are rounded to the nearest $50 increment. Section 7 amends AS 15.13.072E, stating that a candidate may not solicit or accept contributions from an individual who is not an Alaska resident if the amount will exceed 25% of the total contributions made to the candidate during the campaign. Moving on to Section 8, which amends AS 15.13.110I and prohibits the Alaska Public Offices Commission from changing the manner or format in which a candidate must file a report during the campaign period. Section 9 amends AS 15.13.400 to include new paragraph 20 defining campaign period as the period beginning on the date a candidate becomes eligible to receive campaign contributions and ending on the date that candidate must file a final report. That is essentially limited to the 18-month period when a candidate can put in their letter of intent. Section 10 amends AS 24.45.091 to require that reports and statements filed with the commission must be made publicly accessible on their website. Section 11 amends AS 24.45.111B to require that copies of all statements and reports filed with the commission be preserved for a period of 6 years. Copies must be maintained at the commission's central location and be made available on the commission's internet website. Section 12 adds a new section stating that the retroactive language in Section 13 does not apply to campaign contributions made to influence the outcome of an election that occurred on or before the bill's effective date. Section 13 adds an effective date of March 3rd, 2022, to the limits in AS 15.13.070B, C, F, G, and H, as amended in sections 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 9, respectively. Thank you for your time.
Okay, so I'm going to just start. Isn't that a retroactive date, March 3rd, 2022?
Yes.
Okay, so that caught my eye. Before I ask questions, I typically ask members. Senator Holland, do you have any questions at this time?
That was going to be one of my questions, but we'll start at the top. Why $2,000? Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Why $2,000?
Yes, so $2,000. So if you take the $500 individual to candidate limit that was passed by Alaskan voters and adjust that for inflation, it gets to around $700. And then this is changing it to a per campaign period, which is essentially two fundraising years as is. And then we just rounded it up, granted that the next time it would be indexed for inflation would be 10 years down the road, just to make sure we have some comfort room and do not end up with unconstitutional limits during that period.
And this question, if I may proceed, is kind of maybe buried in Section 12 and 13 and the March 3rd, 2022. Could this bill require donations already made have to be reimbursed to donors, because people may have already exceeded the $2,000 thing if they gave the max $1,500 prior to December 31st and the max $1,500 after? Is there a chance that this already is going to affect current donations on the books?
To an extent. So for the period when APOC, the Alaska Public Offices Commission, had their advisory opinion out, those limits were in effect up until that point. So any donations made before March 3rd and after that advisory opinion fell under those limits, if somebody took a full $3,000 during that period and then House Bill 234 were to go into effect, they would not have to give back any of that additional funds as long as they were in compliance with APOC's initial advisory opinion. And Heather Hebden might have additional insights that I do not.
Will you check, please?
Sure. Executive Director Heather Hebden, would you like to weigh in on that? I'm not sure if you heard the question clearly. We can restate it if you did not.
Through the chair, Senator Holland, I believe you're asking if there would be a clawback provision if possibly contributions that were made post March 3rd, the effective date in this bill, whether we would seek to have any overages returned. Is that correct?
Or even pre-March 3rd, does this – I'm kind of looking at that and I'm having a hard time absorbing everything in Section 12 and 13 right now. But, yeah, is there some way that a donor or a candidate might have to reimburse some portion of donations? And the long and short of it is I understand why we're doing this right now, because we have an election season going on right now. But it would seem a lot cleaner to just make this start in the next election cycle. I know there'd be an opportunity for lots of reported monies to come through. Everything's got to be reported. But I just worry about how sticky it's going to be if people are having to go back and retroactively reimburse funds and figure out how much you got to reimburse. And if there's a date, and that even complicates it further, if there's a March 3rd date, so you got to get that money before or after March 3rd. So if you could elaborate on that a little bit.
For the chair, Senator Holland, in staff's opinion, so we issued a draft opinion that ultimately required our commission's approval for it to be official. Anybody that was acting under that guidance until the commission actually considered it and issued their final order on March 3rd, provided they were following staff proposed guidance, we wouldn't be seeking any type of return contribution for that exceeded the $1,500 that staff recommended. Post March 3rd, if this effective date were to take place, it's likely something that staff would present to the commission for their decision on it. It's hard to imagine getting those funds back in the bottle after they've already come out, and especially during a hectic election season.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And also, so even just like some people may have maxed out the donations prior to December 31st, and so they maybe once this election, this legislative session's over, or even candidates who are not incumbents are often or receiving funds right now, they would have to take into account the previous year's $1,500 against that $2,000, or does it start on January 1 of this year?
Through the chair, Senator Holland, according to this effective date, it would start during the campaign season, so it would change the per year basis that contributions are currently considered under to a campaign basis, which would straddle both calendar years.
And probably final question, Madam Chair. Was there any reason 25% from out-of-state donors? I think it's a good number, as good as any, but is it something like states tend to use for out-of-state donors?
Through the chair, for the record again, Eric Gunderson, staff representative, Shoggy. This actually came about through a floor amendment. The original amendment was actually limiting it to 50%, which is the same language in ballot measure 2 requiring an out-of-state disclosure. There was a recommendation on the floor by a representative, I believe, from Kenai to reduce that amount to 25%, that 50% is a pretty sizable amount, which led to the 25%.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I also wanted to first of all say thank you guys for you put your chart, and this chart is amazing. I mean, there's a lot to comprehend in this bill that doesn't meet the eye on what is the limits now, what are the limits post this bill, and you guys have just done an amazing chart for each, you know, individual, for groups, for political parties, and you broke it out to non-groups, individuals, non-residents, inflation indexing, you've talked. And when I look at the Thompson versus Hebden, the reason why the court struck down Alaska statutory political contribution limits, it said it's on the basis that they were too low and not been adjusted for inflation since initially implemented. And to me, that's really important. So they're actually asking us to look at these. And that's why I actually think this bill is really important. And unfortunately, we're having some mechanical or technical issues right now. And so and I think your slide, if there's really 11 really good slides, and I don't want to be holding them up, and I don't want people in the audience to miss. So if you don't mind, if we watch that the next time you come up, and we can look at them. I've looked at it, and it's pretty amazing stuff. And I think you guys did a really, really nice job. But I'm going to see if there's any comments with Senator Kawasaki. Did you have any comments before we set this bill aside?
Nope, not for me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, and I think Senator Holland is good. And so I'm going to go back to the script now. Eric, would you like to make any final comments tonight?
Again, Eric through Gunderson, Staff Representative Shragi through the chair, I just want to say thank you. Really appreciate your time and consideration for House Bill 234. The representative and I look forward to working with you all throughout this committee process on this bill, and also on offer myself. If anyone has any questions before the next committee hearing, I am happy to help set up a meeting on the side to kind of run through this, because it is a lot of information.
It is, and I was really thankful that Representative Shragi and I met. He met with me on 156, and so I heard about his bill, and so I was actually very, very appreciative of that. So with that, per the chair, it says at this time we're going to set this bill aside, and if anyone has amendments, they're actually due on Friday, April 15th, tax day, by close of business, and we're going to bring this bill back up for public testimony and also the presentation, if you could just remind the chair, at a future date. And thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you.
With that, that concludes our business for today. So the Senate State Affairs will meet again Tuesday, April 12th at 3:30 p.m. in this room. And seeing no other business before us today, we will be adjourning at 4:35. Thank you.